And it gives me great pleasure to introduce Gil M. from Oceano.
I'm Gil, I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the 10 a.m. Sunday morning meditation meeting, 11-step meeting at the Village Group, 10 a.m., so come on by. Got a great secretary, and we do the sound bowls there. So, yeah, thanks for asking me to share, Lisa, and leave the meeting, and welcome to our newcomers and our visitor from Oceanside. Thanks. Hope you find some good AA here and go back, and if not, tell them what we're doing wrong, you know. So. And I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life in ways I couldn't even imagine, you know. I got here when I was 30 years old, and it was back in 91, and I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even know that people in AA didn't drink. That's how little I knew. I'm 30, I thought I was pretty smart, and I didn't even know that you didn't drink in AA. And so I went to my first meeting. It's funny because I hear sometimes people, I went to the meeting, everybody was happy. That meeting, nobody was happy. One guy was sitting there crying into his coffee, and he kept on crying for the next 8 months. And it was a beginner's meeting, and I looked at that crowd, and I thought, OMG, you know, before OMG was a thing, right? And I was about to leave, but some lady said, come over here, have a seat, and she brought me like half a cup of coffee, and said, it's going to be okay. And I found out later, she only had like 60 days. And so it's like, you know, you don't have to have a lot of time here to help another alcoholic, you know. And I really believe that, you know, the most important thing is, you know, you got to work the steps, got to get a sponsor, got to get a service commitment. But you also have to, you know, help another alcoholic. But that's what the big book says. That's how we grow, you know. We grow through self-sacrifice and constant thought of others. I say constant work with others, you know. And faith without works is dead. I'm a big book thumper, so I might refer to the big book every now and then here. But there's a story I really like. It's one of my favorite stories in the big book. It's called Keys to the Kingdom. And I just want to read a couple little paragraphs here. It says, AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life. And the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as they do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line. And we find that we're compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience the thrill of challenge and the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques, and we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. Well, I don't know about that last one. I always call that another friggin' opportunity for growth when those happen. And they don't feel like they're really good at the time. But, you know, one thing about my sponsor, I have a sponsor. It's been my sponsor now for, you know, almost 35 years. And, you know, one thing he always talks about is the seemingly bad and the seemingly good. Can't really tell the difference, you know. And he's had some really seemingly bad things happen to him. But, you know, it's turned out to be way better than anything he could have imagined, you know. That's one thing I learned in AA, you know, is that a lot of it is about my perception, how I look at things. I have two ways I could look at it, you know. But when I was drinking, I only had one way to look at it. And that was like, you're out to get me. Everybody's against me. Nobody understands me. And I can get like that in sobriety, too. You know, it's called being dry. And, you know, I won't always notice it, but other people will notice it. And that's why I still keep coming back to meetings, you know. Why am I still coming back to meetings after 35 years? It's because, you know, one, I enjoy it. I enjoy the meetings. I enjoy the people. I have this huge, wonderful fellowship. And it's not just here. It's like everywhere I go. You know, I've been to meetings, you know, I won't say all over the world, but, you know, maybe half the world. And, you know, it's like, yeah, it's pretty cool everywhere. And then, you know, the other thing is, like, I see what happens to people who don't go to meetings. You know, and not all of them drink, but some of them get really weird, even though they're supposedly still sober. And I don't want to be like that. I think that would be worse than drinking, just to be like that, in my opinion, you know. So, You know, my story starts, I was born in San Francisco. That's where I grew up. I was adopted. So I always felt different right from the beginning. And, you know, I found alcohol when I was about 14 or 15. And I remember my first good drunk was a group of friends over the summer. And, you know, that first good drunk, you know, I threw up. I passed out. I crawled off into some bushes. And woke up with, you know, the sun going into the Pacific Ocean. And I remember walking on the beach, still had some puke all over me. And I was thinking, this is great. I want to do this every day, you know. And I didn't really care about the consequences, you know. To me, it's whatever the consequences were, they were going to be worth it, you know. And those first few years were fun drinking. I always said, I won't drink unless I'm in a good mood, right? I'm already making rules for my drinking. I don't even know I'm making rules. And, you know, I'm like 14, 15 making these rules. And when I was 17, we were out drinking out by the Presidio out there, San Francisco. We have those big cliffs. And we used to like to hang out there and drink. You know, we used to like to climb trees and sit, you know, go back and forth in the wind. And which is a lot of fun when you're climbing up. But after you run out of alcohol, you realize you got to come back down. It's like, whoa, it's a long ways, you know. But that day, we didn't have the right alcohol, you know. And so I'm out there trying to climb this cliff. And it didn't work out. And I ended up falling about 70 feet. You know, broke a bunch of bones. I thought I was good dead, you know. And I was going to die, you know. And, you know, they ended up getting a helicopter come take me to the hospital. But, you know, I remember when they, up in the helicopter, the guy's asking me, have you been drinking? And of course, my first answer is, no, I haven't been drinking. He goes, look, you need to be honest with me. He says, I'm going to give you some stuff. I need to kind of get it, you know, the formula right. So, you know, I gave him the standard alcoholic, you know, honest answer. Just a couple. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Just a couple. And, you know, I woke up, you know, in the operating room later. But, you know, it's just that kind of stuff there. You know, I was 17, and I would say that was my first bottom, right? And, you know, but I didn't see it that way, you know. And I used to say, you know, how come nobody did an intervention, you know? Because it's like nobody said, hey, I think you have a drinking problem. You know, people wondering, hey, were you suicidal? What was going on? But, you know, many years later, somebody pointed out the helicopter is a form of intervention. But that's what I'm getting at, right? So anyway, you know, I spent a couple weeks in hospital. They put me back together and then a few more weeks at home kind of recovering. And, you know, I remember I had to go to physical therapy and, you know, and for a long time I had my arm in like a little sling and eventually got out. But, you know, I ended up getting a job. You know, this is like in February when I fell off the cliff. So it was my last year in high school. I'd set up all my classes. I only had one class I really needed to go to. And that class was just, you had to write four reports, right? And I'm a procrastinator, so I waited the very last minute to do that, you know, but managed to graduate. But, you know, I got a job out in this warehouse, working in this warehouse with these two Chinese guys from Hong Kong. And they had a whole bunch of other workers there. I'm the only white guy. And they worked me to death, but they worked everybody to death there, too. So it wasn't just me, you know. And I remember one day, like, the one guy said, my brother's coming back from Hong Kong. He's going to work you 10 times as hard as I work you. And I was like, oh, hell no, you know. And I remember I left there, and I said, you know, I just feel terrible, but I know what will make me feel better is to go get some alcohol. So I went to the store where, you know, I knew I could buy alcohol. And, you know, there's these little lines that I kept crossing, you know, because I used to say I wouldn't drink unless I was in a good mood. But now I'm drinking to change my mood, you know, and I'm 17. And a year later, I ended up joining the Army just because, you know, life was hard. I tried to go to college, but, you know, I was smoking dope, drinking every day. And, you know, I had a crappy little job at McDonald's, and it's just like, I just thought, this sucks, you know. And in the Army, they said, hey, you know, if you go to Texas, you know, because, you know, they take a little test and tell you what your MOS is going to be. And said, if you go to Texas, the drinking age is 18 there. And I was like, oh, that's cool, you know. So I ended up going to Texas, and they didn't lie about it. Drinking age was 18. I went crazy, you know. And, like, I spent, like, 9 months there, did my AIT, did, you know, went through Air Defense School. And, you know, by the time, you know, you get to Air Defense School, you have a lot more freedom. And, you know, people are doing stuff. They're going up to northern New Mexico to go skiing. They're going camping down in Big Bend because, you know, it's down in El Paso, Texas. There's a lot of stuff. And I'm going down to the bar every weekend. You know, I found a little hotel room right above the bar. $4 a night. Sometimes it was $8 a night, you know. And that's what I did. You know, I think I went to the racetrack. That was the big thing. Oh, I went to the racetrack one day. Other than that, it's just that's what I did, you know. And you know, and I was getting in trouble a lot, you know, and I got in trouble a lot in the Army. And I always thought it was because they're picking on me, they don't understand. But, you know, alcohol was always involved, you know. And it's not like every time I drank, I got in trouble. But every time I drank, alcohol was involved, you know. And, you know, I ended up over in Germany. And, you know, I didn't appreciate that people were trying to cover for me or try to help me. I always thought they're interfering and just leave me alone, you know. And you know, one night, just, you know, I kind of lost it with the wrong officer, you know. And, you know, they wanted to court-martial me. I was, like, very incensed about it. So I got a lawyer, you know, I had to get an Army lawyer. And they worked it out. They said, here's what we'll do, you know. We'll go send you to this alcohol, you know, thing where you go once a week, sit in a little circle. I'm not even sure what we talked about in that little circle. But I remember what they said is that if I follow, we all follow the program, that at the end of it, we'd be able to drink two drinks and stop drinking. I tell you, that didn't make any sense to me even back then, you know. And so, you know, I was very rebellious in that. I remember I went high on acid one time to that. They didn't really appreciate that, you know. And they were going to say, okay, we're just going to kick you out. And I was like, great, go. But like I said, people cared about me, you know. And when I wasn't loaded, I actually did my job pretty good, you know. And this one sergeant said, hey, you know, here's the deal, you know. Blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, that's all I heard. Blah, 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 blah. And finally said, but look, if you just do what we ask you and go there and just tell them what they want to hear, we'll give you a promotion and, you know, you won't have to go there anymore. That part I heard. And so the next week, man, I went there, didn't take any acid, just went there and, you know, starched my uniform, shined my boots. And after a couple of weeks, I go, wow, Martinelli, we see a change in you, you know. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I was kind of rebellious against you guys. But you know what? It makes sense what you guys are saying. And they're like, oh, yeah, see, guys, Martinelli's the guy, right? And it was a total lie, you know. I just wanted to get promotion because it meant more money, you know. We're out of attack site. We got, you know, we made our own food, do whatever we want. I mean, so, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, right? When I met my first sponsor in AA, he was an interesting character. He wasn't really very nice, actually, but he could be very caring and compassionate, though, too, at the same time. It was so strange, you know? And I remember we're sitting down after a meeting, because that's what I do. He'd say, meet me at this meeting, bring your big book, bring your 12 and 12, bring something to write with and something to write on. And if I didn't bring that, he would get mad at me, you know? And if I was on the phone even with him, he'd ask me, you got your big book, you got your 12 and 12. And if I didn't have any of those things, he would just hang up the phone. He would just say, just click. And I remember one time I called him back and just clicked again, you know. This is before cell phones. This is 91, you know. So now you can see when they're calling, right? But, I remember he asked me something there, you know, and I thought I was going to lie to him. But then I remember, you know, for some reason that memory of when I lied in that little circle there came back to me. And I just got honest with him. And then he said, that's okay, because a lot of us have that same issue, too. You know, I thought it was so different. You know, I thought nobody has my problems. Nobody's ever done what I did. And I was just alone, you know. I could be in a room like this full of people who cared about me. I would feel alone, you know. Didn't matter. So the Army didn't work out, you know. They got this huge file on me, and I just decided, me and another guy, he didn't have as big a file as I did, but we decided they're not going to mess with us anymore. So we typed up some travel orders and went to New York City. And you know, and God was working there, I think, because, you know, we're going through the customs line, and there's two lines. There's one old guy. He's going through everybody's luggage and just being a pain. And there's other really hot chick over here. And she's like, okay. And I'm thinking, my friend, this one, like, okay. I almost wanted to ask her a number, but I said, no, don't push it, you know. Just get through it, you know. And I remember when I got to New York City, I thought, wow, you know, is there, you know, you know, I finally got settled in, and I was thinking, wow, you know, this is why I drank, because I was around the Army. That they were making me drink. That was a problem. And now I'm here in New York City, and I swear to God, I blacked out that night, you know. And, you know, so many times where I said, okay, I'm not going to drink. Oh, this is a problem. And I changed, you know, places, people, whatever. And just like, yeah, it didn't make a bit of difference, you know. And, yeah, so New York was an interesting situation. And the 49ers got in the Super Bowl that year, so I came back to California. And then settled up with the Army, got out of that. And they wanted me to stay, but, you know, I was doing some stuff that I just knew it would not end good. So I just said, I'll take the other honorable discharge and just go, you know. And that's how my life was, just, you know, just get me out of here and move on to the next thing. And for the next 8 years, I drank alcoholically, you know. And, you know, I had a bunch of different jobs. And every job ended, like, you know, with anger and me usually being drunk and calling somebody on the phone or sometimes in person. And I didn't know you could just leave a job and say, hey, this isn't working for me. Here's my notice, you know, even if you don't want to give 2 weeks notice, you know, and they'd be okay. I didn't know that. And so, you know, the next 8 years, I just drank alcoholically. And during that time, I ended up meeting a woman. She got pregnant, and then we got married later. And, you know, she didn't come from a great family. You know, she came from a lot of trauma and stuff. And I think alcoholics, you know, people who have a lot of trauma, they're attracted to us because, hey, it's what they know. It's familiar, you know. And, you know, and I remember, you know, after I got sober, I really tried to make amends, you know, and I tried a lot of stuff. And I remember I was like 2 years sober, sitting with my sponsor, said, look, I've tried to make amends like this, and nothing seems to work, you know. And he said, did you ask her if she wants her freedom? I was like, not expecting that answer, you know. And I said, why would I ask her that? Well, you know, you've done this and this and this, and it's not working. Why don't you ask her if she wants her freedom? I was like, all right. So I go ask her if she wants her freedom, fully expecting to say, no, I love you. No, she's like, yeah, I want out, you know. And a month later, she moved out. I'm like, all right. So, you know, I always say, I think that marriage would have survived my drinking, but didn't survive my sobriety, you know. And, but, you know, the people, we mess up in AA, like, it's like, I remember I was like 12 years in sobriety, and I'm thinking about how I acted in that relationship. It just came back, stuff. I wasn't. Didn't end up on my four-step or amends. Like, holy shit, you know, I did that, you know. So what happened was, you know, I'm drinking, and I decided toward the end, my drinking at the end was not fun. I didn't enjoy the drinking. Sometimes I'd throw up blood if I drink too much, you know, hard alcohol, so I tried to limit that. But I didn't stop drinking, you know. And so I decided I'm going to stay really busy, and someone has suggested, oh, maybe you might want to be a land surveyor. So I started taking land surveying courses at the community college at night, and on the weekends I had two jobs, you know, I'm busy, you know, and I thought this is going to solve my problem, and it didn't, you know, just, you know, the drinking, when it happened, it was horrible, you know, absolutely horrible, you know, and just, you know, horrible things, you know, and, you know, finally it was like, you know, I did get the good job because I went to school and everything, and I had the nice apartment, had the beautiful wife. And she was really beautiful. She was very nice, you know, and super, super cool wife. But, you know, and the healthy son, you know. And I just wanted to kill myself every day. I hated my wife, you know. I hated me, you know. And I had to have horrible nightmares every night, you know. So I tried to drink until I blacked out. But you know, every day when I started drinking again, it's like, okay, we're just going to have one, maybe two. And then we're going to stop. And then, you know, it would start. And then it was like, oh, I got to drink until I black out, you know. And that last night of drinking, it wasn't anything really crazy, you know. It had started out so good the day before, and it just like one of the little sake of the Japanese, you know, cherry blossom festival in San Francisco, and just kind of escalated. And then, you know, at the end, I said, hey, you know, I wanted to kill myself, but I chickened out. And I said, oh, you know, you should go kill your friends. They're the problem, you know. So I went hunting for them. I didn't find them, thank God, you know. You know, and then the next day I'm just a mess, you know, and then my wife at the time, normally she would yell at me or be angry or do something, and that day she was totally calm, and she just, you know, after I kind of came to, she was like, hey, you know, I can't do this anymore, you know, I think you have a drinking problem, I can't take it, I'm leaving, taking our son with us, and I don't care what you do, but you might want to do something about your drinking, but she said, I don't care anymore, I'm done, and she walked out, you know. And, you know, that may not sound really dramatic, but it was, like, pretty dramatic to me because I love this woman, you know, I did. And back then we had phone books, so it was before the internet. You know, now I could just Google it on my phone, right? Probably would have found out that, you know, people don't drink in AA, and probably wouldn't have gone to my first meeting if I'd known that, you know. So thank God we didn't have the internet then. So I'm going through the phone book, and, you know, I was thinking, okay, maybe I have a drinking problem. Yeah, maybe, right? And, you know, the only place that answered the phone on Sunday morning was Alcoholics Anonymous. And the guy on the phone picked up the phone and said, you know, we talked for a while, and he said, you know, AA can help you be happy. I don't know how he figured that one out, that I wasn't happy. But he said, AA can help you be happy, and gave me a beginner's meeting. So I went to that beginner's meeting tonight where the guy was crying into his coffee cup. And, and walked in and sat down. And, you know, something happened to that meeting, you know, I wasn't expecting, you know. There was a woman, she was like 14, she had like 6 months of sobriety, you know. And there was, you know, other people who had different lengths, you know. I think the guy who had the most sobriety was 7 years in that meeting, you know. And, you know, and the speaker, the person who led the meeting, you know, I knew nothing about AA, who these two people, I thought they were from the Salvation Army or something, you know. And the person who led the meeting, she cried through her whole share. And you know what, that impressed me. She says she had like 5 or 6 years. She cried through her share. I'm like, wow, you know, I want what she has, you know, because I could never just cry unless I was really drinking. You know, my emotions were shut down. Somehow I related to that, you know, and I went and talked to her afterwards and she said, you know, we don't do this alone. I never forgot that. We don't do this alone, you know, and during my drinking, I always thought if I could get around people who didn't drink, maybe I would like, you know, not drink too, but whenever I'd hang around with them, I couldn't stand them after a week and I just want to drink more, you know, and yeah, so, and they said, and somebody said it's just one day at a time, and they gave me this little pamphlet. They had this little pamphlet for beginners that the San Francisco in a group office had put out, and it said, AA has helped thousands of people solve their alcohol problem, and it can work for you too, but we're not going to change it for you, so get used to doing it, you know, our way. But I thought that's kind of arrogant, you know. But I said, well, you don't have any other ideas. I was out of ideas. That was so good. Thank God I was out of ideas. I had no idea what to do about my drinking. And these people here in AA had a solution, you know. And so I started going to AA. And I was working on a survey crew. So it's kind of small. So the guys, you know everything about everybody when you're working on a small survey crew and you're out there all day traveling around. And so, you know, these guys would kind of make fun of me, you know, about, oh, you're an AA. And then they made me the designated driver. Which, you know, at first, oh, okay, yeah, I'm cool. You know, I'm cool with it, you know. But after a few months, I got kind of tired of it, you know. And you know, my first 100 days, man, I was so angry. I just wanted to pick a fight, you know. And somebody told me early on, they said, you know, for most alcoholics, we recommend 90 meetings in 90 days. But for alcoholic your type, you need 290 meetings in 90 days. You might have a chance, you know. Which I was a bit offended by, but it was like good advice. So I took it, you know. And so I used to go to a lot of meetings. And I used to walk a lot. You know, I'd be so angry. I'd just go for walks and just, you know, I always looking to pick fights and something in my first 100 days. And nobody ever did, you know, thank God, you know. And I had the sponsor, Len. And Len was great. You know, Len, he really showed me how to use this big book because I'm a reader. I know how to read. And when I met Len, I had a couple weeks sober. He says, you know, do you have a big book? I go, yeah. So have you read it? I know, like, I'm thinking, well, I haven't read it all the way through, but I was already into the story. So I'd read the first 164 pages. And at that point, the only thing that really made an impression on me in the first 164 pages was talking about the man who did a great deal of spree drinking. And then when he was 30, he stopped abruptly. And I'm 30. Hey, I relate to that, right? And then he stayed bone dry for 25 years and then picked up the drink again. And with 4 years, he was dead. And I was thinking, whoa, you know. You know, idea of staying sober 25 years at the point didn't even seem realistic, you know. But I met Len, you know, because I wanted to work the steps, but I didn't understand step three. It made no sense. And every time I talked to somebody in AA, they had a different answer. That really confused me. And finally, people said a sponsor can help you with that. So I'm at a meeting one night, and this guy, Len, he's talking. He's sharing his story. And he's totally cool about it. You know, we had some disruption in the meeting. We had to take a group conscience, ask two people to leave. And they were angry about it because they were drunk, but, you know. But Len was cool. He said, if those people want to go and behave and not disrupt the meeting, they're welcome to come back, you know. And I thought, wow, that's so cool. He was cool, you know. And he has like 17 years. So I went and asked him to be my sponsor. And he told me he didn't have time to sponsor me, but he helped me work the steps if I wanted to do that. And so we started getting the big book. And there's so much stuff hidden in the big book, you know. I remember I called him one time. I was upset at somebody's driving. He said, I want you to turn to page 67. And 67 has the prayer for people who anger us, right? Some people call it the sick man prayer. I call it for the prayer for people who anger us and offend us, right? And so we read that, and he said, that's what we do. And I said, Len, that doesn't seem very practical. And I thought he was going to hang up the phone because he got really upset. And so, you know, so I started using that prayer when people offended me, you know. You know, God, this sick person, how can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. You know, help me to avoid retaliation, argument, thy will not mine be done, you know. And that's also a really good thing to do, I found, doing the resentment inventory, you know. after I've done that resentment, or if I'm working with somebody, we'll stop and we'll do that prayer together. And it makes a difference. And then we'll go into the fear list, you know. And then at the fear list, we'll stop there after, you know, each list of fears, and we'll do the fear prayer. It says, God, I ask you to remove this fear and direct my attention to what you have me be. And then there's a sex prayer, too, and some other prayers. But those two prayers, man, when you combine them with the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, they just make a huge difference, you know. And so Len was always big about the prayers, you know. And I wasn't big on prayer, you know. And it's not like I had antipathy toward God or anything. But I felt like, you know, God should do what I wanted him to do. You know, and that, you know, if I got spiritual enough, I could be a God too, you know. And yeah, and then what actually he really had me do that really changed it is he had me start doing that St. Francis of Assisi prayer. That's on page 99 in the 12 and 12. And he said, I want you to do that every morning and then be quiet for 30 seconds before you leave the house. And when you come home at night, when you're done having contact with people, do it again before you go to bed. And so I started doing that. And, you know, and in little ways, it started to change, you know. And I started to become a little less fearful. Like I said, I was very angry my first 100 days. But I remember when I got my 90-day chip, I was just amazed, you know. And I remember sitting in my car one morning looking at this 90-day chip saying, how did this happen? It just didn't even feel real, you know. And I was just amazed. And you know, a sense of amazement has never left. I've always felt amazed ever since. It's like, wow. Because it's like this is a program of limitless expansion, you know. And, you know, so that sponsor-sponsee relationship with Len, it didn't really work out. Sometimes he could be very kind of rude, and I felt kind of mean and belittling. And you know, after I had about 90 days, I said, yeah, this isn't working for me. And one day we just kind of hung up the phone on each other, you know, and I never called him back, you know. And but he had got me started. He showed me how to do the four-step, you know, using the columns. And they also had, like, four-step workshops back then in San Francisco. So they would do, like, you know, first week would be resentment, second week would be fears, third week would be sex, and then the last one would be, you know, who you harm, kind of wrap it all up, you know. So I went to a few of those, and I'm writing, you know. And that was the thing. If you went to the workshop, you had to bring a pad with you, or they would even have a pad for you to write. You couldn't just sit there and do nothing. You had to actually write, you know, or they'd ask you to leave, you know. You know, that changed my whole life doing that, you know. And I remember I wrote this huge inventory, and, you know, I got to the point where I said I could see what my part was just, you know, really quickly in a lot of things. I was like, okay, I'm done. I put it away. And I had written it with the full intention to never share this four step because there's no way. There was stuff in there I was so ashamed of, a lot of sexual stuff I was ashamed of. I am not sharing this with anybody. And but I still kept going to meetings. You know, and I had some service commitments, you know. And eventually, you know, my thinking became the point where, like, I wanted to kill myself again, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, it might be better to drink before you kill yourself, you know. And then I think, well, you never did the fifth step. And they said, you know, if you don't do the fifth step. And actually, I heard that, you know, people used to share in meetings, hey, I went out because I didn't do my fifth step or I didn't do my ninth step. And so I started looking around for people to go and do my fifth step with. And I would approach somebody and I would chicken out. And I thought, oh, I'm never going to find somebody to do this with, you know. And then this guy that I didn't like, who I met at my early on in my first week of sobriety. So I had like three home groups when I was new. I had the Sunday morning big book meeting. I had the two midnight meetings, Friday and Saturday. And I was always there. I was in service to them all. And so at the Saturday morning, you know, I became the coffee maker, and then he raised his hand and said he'll be the co-coffee maker. And I found out later, because he was worried, cause I think I had like 60 days at the time, that, you know, I might not show up, so at least the meeting would have coffee, you know. But we started to develop this friendship, which I wasn't expecting, because I didn't like this guy, you know. And one day we're sitting there before the meeting, and he's sharing some stuff with me. I thought I wouldn't share that with somebody if I was drinking even, you know. And a week later, I told him, hey, you know, I got this four step, and, you know, could you hear my fifth step? And so I ended up doing my fifth step with him. And, you know, he's been my sponsor ever since, you know. And I was so scared to do that, you know. And, you know, we started out in a coffee shop, and I'm going through it. And it gets to a point where, like, you know, I don't want to go on, you know. And I said, I can't do anymore because, you know, it's getting to the juicy part, you know. You start off, it's not too juicy, and he laughs, let's go back to my apartment. It's right around the corner, you know. And I asked him, I said, how come you didn't want to do this in the first place? I mean, you're scared of me or something? No, he said, I want to see if you wrote an honest fist up. And if you had done the whole thing in the coffee shop, I was going to tell you it wasn't very honest. It wasn't very nice. But so anyway, that four step, that fifth step, man, changed my life again, in a way. I felt this huge weight left off of me, because I was as honest as I could be. And I thought that stuff that I couldn't share with anybody because it was so weird. He would say, oh, yeah, I did that too. And he would tell me stories. And then as I'm going through it, because it was really long, because I wrote a lot, he would fall asleep. Or I thought he fell asleep. And every now and then he'd wake up with something I thought wasn't that big a deal. So let's go over that, And so what I learned is that, really the fourth step is about finding your patterns. That's what it's not a witch hunt. It's about finding the patterns, I've done other four steps in sobriety. I'm in the process of moving. I'm planning to go to North Dakota here in a couple months, so I'm cleaning out my house and I come across this old inventory, actually. I've done more than one four step in recovery. Some people say, oh, you only do one, you're done. Whatever, not me, okay. And I've done a lot of 10 steps, but I've actually done deep dives because, I don't know about anybody else, but man, there are times where I've hit bottoms in sobriety and I'm not drinking. But I am just, once again, miserable and happy, blaming everybody. I remember in 2007, man, I was lying to my sponsor, and I knew I was lying to him, And then I continued lying for another 5 years and finally I kind of come clean, It's like, And that was a whole nother new bottom, Like, I didn't drink or use, but, my behavior was fucking nuts, man. Excuse my English, And, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous that they were there, And there's other 12-step programs, too. Thank God for those, too, So, life has been good, like I said, the marriage ended, and, I ended up meeting the love of my life in AA, and it was great. I thought, this is it, we'd known each other in AA for about 4 years before we started dating. I thought, this is great, and it was great, It was like the best relationship ever, And I was getting ready to ask her to marry me, And one day somebody called me, and they were supposed to go to some kind of play. Is there something wrong with Lori? I'm like, huh, all right. So I go over there, man, she is whacked out, man. It turns out she was high as hell, on drugs, And her favorite thing was Valium. She liked to get a whole bottle of Valium and just down it and then pass out, And so anyway, so I was like, I don't know what to do. I want to rescue her. And my sponsor says, you need to get away from her because, you can't help her, And that was really hard, setting that boundary. Said, hey, if you're going to drink and use, I can't be around you, right? And the thing is, on her life, her life had gotten so good. She was basically like a CFO, and yet here she was, she couldn't stay sober, and for the next 2 years, she was in and out of recovery homes and in and out of treatment programs. And, eventually she died from overdose, and about 2 months before she died, she got the best job ever. CFO with some cancer startup, and this is a woman, she barely had high school education, a little bit of college, and she built herself up that in sobriety. And I mean, that was really devastating. And I didn't think so much about drinking, I thought about more about taking a long swim in the ocean, but that I got through that. I didn't have to drink through that or use, AA was there for me, AA carried me, I couldn't carry myself, And, I've been through the death of both my parents. When my mom passed away, that was really hard, And my father, I did that one okay. But my mom, I don't know, I just went to this place of darkness I wasn't expecting. And for a year, it felt like I had no connection with my higher power. And, the big book, the 12 steps, we pray and meditate. So I just continued to do that, and eventually I got that connection back. But, it's always been a struggle ever since then to meditate. Before that, it was easy to meditate. Now it's a lot of work, And so I looked for a lot of different ways to meditate. And, so that's why we started the meeting, so we could have different ways to learn how to meditate, But there's been some great times, too. I have a son, and he was 5 when I got here, and now he's 41. I can't believe it. And you know, I thought, you know, he grew up in around sobriety, used to come to meetings. He won a big book one time at a meeting, you know. I thought, oh, man, this guy's never going to drink, right? He did. And he's one of us. And, man, he took it way further than I did. And, you know, he's sober now, you know. And it's not his first time in sobriety, but I think it's going to stick. I don't know. I ended up having to do Al-Anon, you know. First did Al-Anon for the girlfriend. And then when it didn't fix her, I thought Al-Anon is stupid. So I stopped going to Al-Anon. Then when my son started drinking, it was a friggin' disaster. Then I started going to Al-Anon. And my sponsor used to say, you know, you're trying to... By then, he was doing Al-Anon. He said, yo, you're trying to do a rescue, you know. No, I'm not. I'm just trying to help them, you know. You know, it's kind of hard to see sometimes. But, you know, and life's been good. So I moved around a lot in sobriety. You know, I got sober in San Francisco. I moved down to San Jose. And they did meetings so different from there. I was so angry. I call my sponsor all the time. Call anybody who would listen to me. Tell them about the latest stupid thing they did in the meeting. And finally, my sponsor says, you know, you really ought to tell them what they're doing wrong so they can fix it. I'm like, thank you. I figured that out like before he did, but I was waiting for the green light, right? So the next minute I go, I raise my hand. They don't raise their hand down there. They call on you and you're supposed to go up to the podium. I raised my hand and stood up and told them what they were doing wrong in the meeting. And they said, thank you for sharing. Keep coming back. You know? But I met people who didn't like the meeting either. So we got our own little fellowship after the meeting, you know? And after about a year of living there, I'm sitting in the meeting. I'd gotten a service commitment, and service is always the answer. You know, I didn't know it. Like, you know, like whenever I moved to a new area now, I just, you know, pick up a mop and a broom or a vacuum cleaner, whatever, just get into service, you know, and it makes a difference. But I didn't know that back then. You know, I had to learn it. But I'm sitting in this meeting one time, and, you know, I'm then there about a year. I'm looking around. I'm sober. These guys sober. I'm kind of making some friends. It's like, who cares if they're doing it wrong, right? And it was so funny because the secretary of that meeting that we elected that day when I happened this revelation, there was no coffee, right? And how come there's no coffee? And she said, well, I feel that coffee is a drug, and so we shouldn't have coffee. So, you know, I'm like, that's not cool, guys. We need to take a group conscience. So, you know, anytime you say, hey, guys, we ought to do something, you get elected. So I became the coffee maker of that meeting, you know. And, but then I fell apart of, so it's cool. And, you know, I moved down here after my son graduated high school. He went and decided to go play Army for a while and did that. And, you know, and I was really proud of him. He did really good. He did really good in the Army when he wasn't drinking. But he was drinking, it would just become this disaster. And there was nothing to do. I remember one time I went and visited him down at Fort Bragg. And he had just finished, like, this special forces school. And I go in the house. It's just a disaster, man. Just a mess. And it's like, what can you do? You know? And all I could do is just start washing dishes, you know? Start cleaning up. That's all I could do. You know? So. But, you know, the good thing is, like, yeah, he had his own journey, and, you know, he's sober now, so that's great. So I'm so happy, you know. And, you know, and that's how I ended up going to North Dakota. He ended up marrying a local up there, a native. And I got grandkids that are direct descendants of Sagawea and stuff, so it's kind of cool. And, you know, I've become, like, at home in that fellowship up there. And, you know, the group I used to go to is called the Serenity Group. So I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. I got the Serenity Group here, they got the Serenity Group there, and there's other groups. And, you know, and I go up there, they know people. And, you know, it's so interesting because there's a story in this big book I really like. It's called Grounded. And, you know, sometimes people think, oh, you know, I ruined my life so bad. That guy really ruined his life. You know, he's 50 years old and he got, you know, goes to prison because, you know, he's drinking, you know, and he's an airline pilot. So he'll never be an airline pilot again, right? But then, you know, he gets out of prison and somebody convinces him, maybe you can do it. So he started to do it, you know. And, you know, eventually the airline, you know, after he did all the work, getting all the licenses and stuff, and somehow they said, oh, wow, he's in the AA. They brought him back and let him become a pilot. And he finished as a pilot, you know. And what's interesting is that airline that he was part of, I met this woman in Concord. She had 45 years of sobriety when she passed away. Her name was Harriet. And Harriet was a trip, man, because... You know, she got sober back in the 70s up in Minot, North Dakota, and she could barely write. She became this huge journalist, you know. And but she used to like to write bad checks for the airlines, because back then you could write checks, right? And so that was part of her men. She had to go to this airline, you know, as part of her men's, and go talk to the vice president of the airline and worked out a payment plan, right? And the last check she made, she actually had to meet the guy in person because I wanted to meet him in person, you know. And he said, man, you were so impressed with me. Changed my life. You're an example. We don't realize we change people's lives, right? And that airline pilot, he actually worked for that same airline. So I wonder if maybe Harriet didn't set the stage for something that would happen later. You know, we talk about our amends. We don't know what's going to happen when we do our amends, you know? And sometimes it can be so scary, you know? But, you know, you go through them and, you know, maybe it didn't feel like anything happened now, but, you know, maybe you set the stage for something, you know? I mean, it's just such a crazy world, right? We just don't know the effects we have on other people. Anyway, I think I'm up with my time. So thank you for letting me share, and have a great day. Thank you.
All right, let's give Gil another round of applause. Thank you, Gil, for speaking tonight. Anybody who would like to come up after the meeting to thank the speaker is more than welcome.